I'm Ann Dart.
I'm Tracy Stormy.
And I'm Kathy Knight.
And together we are...
It Was a Dark and Stormy Book Club.
A podcast for mystery lovers.
Welcome. Welcome back to our second special episode of In Agatha's Footsteps. We are very excited to announce Victoria Thompson, who writes the Gaslight Mystery Series.
Edgar and Agatha nominated author Victoria Thompson writes the Gaslight Mystery Series set in turn of the century New York City and featuring midwife Sarah Brandt. Her latest, Murder on Union Square, is a May 2018 release. City of Lies is the first book in her new Counterfeit Lady series, a November 2017 release from Berkeley. The second book in the series, City of Secrets, will be out in November of this year. She also contributed to the award-winning writing textbook, Many Genres / One Craft. Victoria teaches in the Seton Hill University Master's Program in Writing Popular Fiction. She lives in Illinois with her husband and a very spoiled little dog.
So without further ado, we are pleased to present our interview with Victoria Thompson.
We would like to introduce and welcome Victoria Thompson, who is the award-winning author of the Gaslight Mystery Series, starring Sarah Brandt and Frank Malloy, and their adventures. And I've read every one, and I just love this series. I've loved it since I picked up the first one.
And this part of our podcast, we'll let you know this, Vicki, that we have started a new segment. We mostly focus on authors who are not yet household names, but we've started a new segment where we call it In Agatha's Footsteps. And you are our second recipient of that. This is where we will ask an established author some advice for authors who are just getting started.
That sounds great.
Our first question is, what did you have to do to research the time period? We know you're not old enough to have been
there. I feel like I am. A lot of people say, I couldn't write a historical because I wouldn't enjoy the research. That, to me, is the fun part, is the research. And when I first started, I was poor and I couldn't afford to buy books. So I would go to the library and spend a lot of time in the library checking out books and finding books. And since I've become more successful now, I buy them and I have a huge reference library here now of books. And luckily, my time period is recent enough that there are a lot of photographs of that time period. And looking at a photograph is like so much easier than you can read pages and pages of text and not get as much detail as if you look at one photograph and you can see what people are wearing, what kind of furniture's in the room, what the decor looks like, what the city street look like, who's walking and what they're wearing and all that kind of stuff. It's really, really makes it a lot easier to see a photograph. So I'm very fortunate there that I have photographs to look at, but I have just a lot of books. And the way I research, and in fact, I'm doing that this week as we speak, is I'll sit down and with it being a series, both of my series are series. And so I know pretty much the time period that the next book's going to be set. So I just sit down and start reading what was going on in the world at that, and especially in New York City during that time period. And when I get to something that makes me say, oh, I didn't know that, then I know that's what's going in the book. So I'm doing right now looking for that aha moment.
Yes. Well, I like the way you add in real characters from history into the story, like Mr. and Mrs. Brandt will have Theodore Roosevelt. come for a visit, or one of the rich, wealthy billionaires that were around at that time. So,
yeah, that's fun to be able to do that. And it was, I was sad when I got to the time when Teddy actually had to leave New York because he went to the Spanish-American War. He first went to Washington to become Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and then he was fighting the Spanish-American War. But I really missed him. Now he's governor, and pretty soon he's going to be vice president and then president.
Oh, so, my goodness.
I think Nick and Sarah are going to have to visit him in the White House.
That would be great.
So one of the other characters that we really enjoy is Mrs. Ellsworth. And we were wondering, are the superstitions that she keeps putting out there, are they real, or do you make them up, and do you believe these superstitions?
Okay, that's a lot of questions.
It's really just one big question.
What everybody wants to know about Mrs. Ellsworth, and it is true, every single one of those is a real superstition. I have like a collection of superstition books. And when I often regretted giving her that quirk, because every book I have to come up with a superstition. You'd think it'd be pretty easy, because I mean, I have 3 or 4 books that are like really thick, full of superstitions, but about 99% of them are all things that happen on a farm.
Oh, well, that won't work.
She's too urban for that.
Most of these things would not ever happen in New York City. So it's like, okay, I just literally, when I get to that point in the book where I have to come up with a superstition, I have to stop for a day or two flipping through all these books, trying to find a superstition that will work for her. And people have often said to me, why don't you just make one up? And what a great idea. I wish I could. I think it was because my mom was superstitious that I just do not believe in any of that stuff. And so my brain just will not come up with one. But you will notice, and I don't know, no one's ever pointed this out to me, but it's true. All of her superstitions, if it's like an omen,
it's
going to happen, it happens.
Yes, it does.
Well, she is very enjoyable. We are glad that you gave her that quirk. Maid has grown during the years in book installments. Do you see a separate line of books devoted to her and her story?
Well, you didn't ask me if she and Gina were going to get together, because that's the other question.
That was next.
You know, I really did not plan this series to be this long. I never dreamed in a million years that I'd be fortunate enough to have a series that went on for over 20 books. So I didn't foresee Maeve even existing in the beginning. And when I first started writing, when I was writing my very first mystery, I contacted one of my friends, Jill Churchill, who had a very successful...
I've read her books.
So I asked her what she wished she had known before she started writing the series. And one of the things she said was she wished she had realized that her youngest child, she had given her hair on 3 children, and the youngest one was like 8 years old. The other two were teenagers, so they were fine. But the 8-year-old always had to have a babysitter. She couldn't just like leave him anywhere. So he's always going to play at a neighbor's house or stay with his grandparents or going somewhere, because he was always... had to be taken care of. So she said, just don't have any kids that need to be taken care of. So I thought that was really good advice. So in the beginning, Frank has a son, but his mom takes care of him.
Yes.
So
yes,
I was taken care of. So when I realized that Sarah was going to adopt this little girl, I thought she needs a live-in nanny. So, you know, I plucked a girl out of the house and just sent her over to live with Sarah, never dreaming that she would develop into anything important. So then, of course, she's took on a personality and a life of her own. And next thing I know, she's helping Sarah solve mysteries, which actually worked out really well. When I got to Murder on Bang Street, I realized Sarah could not investigate that murder because they would recognize her. They would know who she was. So that's how Maeve was sort of forced into duty, because Sarah couldn't do it. And she was so good at it that she just sort of, you know.
She loves it.
And she's starting out. I think she's going to start working part-time at the...
she's a natural.
Because Catherine's in school now all day. So she doesn't have anything to do.
That's true.
So she's going to have something to fill her time, I think. In one of the recent books, Frank observes that he's going to have to find her something to do.
Yes.
But, yeah, I can see, this isn't the first time somebody's asking that, so I've certainly thought about it, Maeve and Gino, that if I think I would probably have to end the Gaslight series and then start, pick up a few years later with Maeve and Gino.
Wow.
If that ever happens. But right now, they're still very young.
Yes.
Get married. Well, they're young. And everybody says, well, they got married young in those days. Just or anything. So, yeah, love a romance. But I think I'll make you wait a little longer.
Just as an aside, why did you have Frank become a millionaire?
Well, that's an interesting story because, well, when I started out, it just seemed like a good idea to have something, you know, that they wouldn't be able to get together.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of thought when the series started, they gave me a three book contract. And I thought maybe if I'm really, really lucky, I'll get another three book contract and I'll have a six book series. And I was thinking, oh, you know, and maybe in the last book, they'll get married. But then the series just kept going on and on. And I had so many obstacles in their way. And I don't know if people today can really understand. You know, a lot of people will say, well, this is America. They could get married. And I'm like, yes, they could. But it would be like if Ivanka Trump married the Muslim gardener.
Yes.
There's so many reasons why that could never happen.
It being an couldn't. Irish cop.
So it was just the Catholic thing, the Irish thing, yep. The cop thing. He's poor. And even if she was willing, and she probably would have been willing to give up everything to marry him, he would never ask her to do that because it would mean she would never be welcomed in society again.
Right.
None of her parents' friends would receive her as the wife of an Irish policeman. And so all those doors would be closed to her. And it would also make the series kind of boring. But all these things going against me. But I started getting all these fan letters from people saying, they have to get together. It's been, you know, all these years. It was only like 2 years for them. It was like 15 years.
Exactly.
I could understand. I was getting a little antsy too, and I could not for the life of me figure out a way to get them together. So I was actually in a master's program at the time, and one of my fellow students, I had mentioned that I was going to have a contest with my readers and ask my readers to come up with an idea of how they could get together. And thank heaven I didn't, because my readers didn't come up with any of the ideas. And rejected. But one of the students, whose name was David Wilbanks, and he was a young guy, wrote science fiction, had never read anything I'd written, knew nothing about my series. And if there's a person on the planet who's complete opposite of me, it's David. He was at that time wearing his hair in a mohawk, like a football spray at different colors. And the picture he used for his online class, he was smoking a bong. So what out there compared to conservative me. So he sends me a private email. He says, I accept your challenge. I will come up with an idea for how they can get together. And he sent me a list of about 20 ideas.
Wow.
And so I was, of course, very skeptical. Think of something when I couldn't think of something. So I'm reading down, no, that's stupid. No. And then I read one. I thought, wait a minute, that could work. And it wasn't exactly, he had suggested that Frank inherit money from a rich relative that he didn't know he had. But, you know, he's Irish, so he never had a rich relative. So that wasn't going to work. But then I realized that could work. It didn't have to be his relative. And not only would it work, but it would work in the book I was writing at that very moment, because that was the Murder in Chelsea, where you will notice Catherine's father's name is David Wilbanks. I named him after him who came up with that idea. And in America, the great equalizer, as Sarah's father points out, is money.
Yes.
And so it doesn't matter if he's Irish or Catholic. If he's got money, they will forgive him anything.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the Vanderbilts aren't going to invite him over for tea, but he's going to go to tea with them anyway.
Yeah. That's true.
The important thing was he could make a home for Sarah and provide for her and be respectable without being a cop anymore. And he's, you know, just as rich as her parents now. So that was why it worked out that way. And thank heaven it did, because I had so many fans that were ready to lynch me.
Do you feel that female writers are taken more seriously now than in the past?
I wish I thought that was true. I think it's getting better. I mean, it's better than it was 100 years ago, certainly. And it's better than it was even when I started writing this series. I think we're talking about it more. But the organization Sisters in Crime was originally organized because they saw that women were not being nominated for the big prestigious awards. Women's books were not being reviewed in all the prestigious publications. They organized Sisters in Crime to address that. And they actually still to this day have a committee that counts how many women and how many men are reviewed, like in the New York Times Book Review and other places where books are reviewed. And it's still, you think it'd be at least even Stephen now, but it's not. It's still greatly skewed toward male writers. So.
Well, that's unfortunate.
At least it's being talked about, and hopefully in the near future, we'll see a change on that front. I think authors like Gillian Flynn, I think she flipped the narrative there and got people looking that they can write hard-hitting just as well as a man.
Exactly. And if you look at the thrillers being published today, so many of them are being published by women, which was not true even 10 years ago. So,
right.
Yeah, we're definitely moving in the right direction, but we still have a ways to go.
That's good.
Okay. So if we want to give some advice to up and coming authors, perhaps some female authors, what stumbling blocks did you have to climb over to get your first book published?
Well, it was interesting. I had written this book, and I don't know that I even really thought about getting it published while I was writing it. It was just, I had got this idea, and I was thinking about it night and day, and I had plotted out this whole book in my mind, and then I wrote it by hand in spiral notebooks between 9 and 11 at night after my kids were in bed. So when it was done, I thought, maybe I should try to get it published. So I typed it up on a manual portable typewriter, and I started sending it out to it wasn't a mystery. It was a historical set in the Old West. And I had been reading Max Brand and Zane Grey and Louis L'Amour and all those old Western writers, which is how I came up with an idea for a Western. And so I thought it was a Western, and I sent it out to 5 publishers over a course of a couple years who published Westerns, and they all rejected it. And by the time the 5th rejection came back to me, I had finally figured out that it actually was a historical romance set in the Old West. So I had sent it to an agent, and she said it wasn't ready for publication, but I should send it to Zebra Books, which is now Kensington. And she said they kind of specialize in first-time authors, and I should give it a try and send it to them, and they might have some pointers for me. So I'm in complete ignorance. I did exactly the right thing. I typed up a cover letter that said this agent had suggested I send the book to them. So it immediately went to the top of the slush pile, and the editor read it. And it was like less than a week later, I got a phone call from this. And this editor said, "I'm Karen Cohen. I'm an editor with Zebra Books." And I didn't know a lot about publishing, but I knew they don't call you on the phone to tell you you're rejected. So I got very excited. And she said, "I really like your book. It's really funny." That was the first I knew it was funny. She said, "But it needs to be 200 pages longer and it needs more sex." I thought, oh, okay. And then I had read some romances, and I realized, in my book, they kissed a few times. And I knew that was not going to cut it with a romance. So she said, "I'll sit down with you and we'll go through the manuscript on the phone, and I'll show you where to put in the love scenes." And I said, "Okay." She said, "If you revise it to please us, then we'll buy it." And I was like, "Well, okay, I'll give it a shot." So we sat down one day on the phone, and she went through, she had a copy and I had a copy, and she would tell me what page. She would say, "Now this is where you have to put a love scene." And she would tell me what had to happen in the love scene. Like he would put his hand up her dress in this scene. At one point she says, "You're being awfully quiet. Am I embarrassing you?" And I'm like, "No, I'm just taking notes." I put more sex in the book and revised it to their satisfaction, and they bought it. And that was my first book. So that was not easy by today's standards, really a Cinderella story, because I sold the first book that I ever wrote, which hardly ever happens to anyone. So I was very blessed in that respect. And I published 20 historical romances. And then my career kind of tanked because historical romances did so well, they decided to publish more and more and more of them. And what they forgot to do was create more readers. So they had the same number of readers. the reader just had four times as many books to choose from every time.
They saturated the market.
Yes.
So individual sales went down and for many authors, and I was one of them. And so my publisher dropped me because my sales were so low. My agent had been after me to try writing a mystery for a long time. I was actually trying to write a thriller. What I discovered is I really don't have a modern voice, that I have a historical voice. I'm much more comfortable with historicals. But I was sending her all these proposals for contemporary thrillers, and she called me up one day. She said, I just had lunch with an editor from Berkeley, and she said they're looking for somebody to write a series set in New York City where the heroine is a midwife. Would you be interested? She said,
yes.
I thought of you. Like, well, okay. Because I had, my youngest daughter had just started college at NYU. So my husband and I had spent time walking around Greenwich Village. We'd even bought a couple books on the history of Greenwich Village because we were interested, you know. So I'd already done some research, and I was working at that time for the March of Dimes, and some of my volunteers were midwives. Well, this is like, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll tell you a little secret. Just between us, they said they were looking for someone to write a series set in medieval Mesopotamia with a potter. I would have said, excuse me.
Of course you would.
Oh, that's funny.
Public begins. So I wrote a proposal. They told me her name was Sarah Brand and that she was a midwife. Their suggestion was that she was a poor relation of a wealthy family. I said, no. She needs to have the ability to move in all levels of society. So I made her the rebellious daughter.
Right.
And I knew she would need, as a midwife, she probably would not encounter a lot of murdered people in the course of her everyday life. So I gave her Frank as the sidekick, figuring he is the, as a police officer, it'd be his job to solve murders. And so that would help a lot with finding the dead bodies and getting them involved.
I don't know. Some of those wealthy families had some deep, dark secrets that they they didn't want anybody to know about.
My agent always points out the rich people are much more interesting than poor people.
They can afford to be more interesting. If you could give any advice to new authors, what would you advise them to help them in their process?
Well, writers today are so much more fortunate than I was when I started, in that we have the internet and there's so much information available out there. There are many, many really good how-to books, no matter what kind of genre you want to write in or what kind of book you want to write. There's at least one really good how-to book out there that you can get. There are also many really good support organizations for writers. I mentioned Sisters in Crime. There's Mystery Writers of America. There's Romance Writers of America. There's all kinds of Horror Writers of America. Pretty much every genre has its own, at least one really good organization that you can join, and they will help you, teach you everything you need to know to get published. I actually teach in a master's degree program at Seton Hill University, which is in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. It's a master's program in writing popular fiction and low residency program. So you only spend a week on campus every semester and then you go back home. It's for people who have real lives and can't take 2 years off of their job to get a master's degree. So this is designed especially for people who work and have lives. And they do everything online then during the semester. And your thesis is a novel. So you have a person, a mentor assigned to you to help you critique your pages that you write every month. And at the end, you have a completed manuscript that's been thoroughly vetted by professionals. And you've learned pretty much everything you need to know. So that's
great.
That sounds wonderful.
That's like the extreme. Or you can pick up a lot of stuff that you need to know on the internet and by joining a writer's organization. So those would be my advice to you, to learn as much as you can before you get started, because you'll save yourself a lot of trouble if you know what's expected before you write the book.
Good advice. What writers inspire Victoria Thompson?
Oh, my. Well, in the beginning, it was actually, my husband was the news director at a TV station back then, and we were living in Altoona, Pennsylvania. And for some reason, this publisher sent him paperback books every month, and we never did figure out why, but he would get the books. And he'd bring them home to me. And I was, at that time, I had two young children and I was babysitting five kindergarten kids during the day. And I had just started reading for pleasure again. I had, had young children and babies and, you know, didn't have much time for reading. So I just started reading for pleasure. So he brought home these books. So I was reading them. And one of them was a collection of Louis L'Amour short stories. And just to show you how completely out of it I was, I thought, you know, this guy's pretty good. I wonder if he's written anything else.
Yeah, one or two others.
Others. Yeah, I went to the library, and of course, they had a whole shelf of Louis L'Amour books, and I ended up reading every single one of them and branching out to read all kinds of other books. So Louis really inspired me, and it's kind of funny in the way he inspired me. And then I read like Zane Grey and Max Brand and a lot of other men who wrote mysteries or westerns. And I thought, you know, I'd like to write a book. I was getting fed up with these books because the female characters always fainted at the wrong stupid and got kidnapped and had to be rescued. And it was like, this was just really getting annoying. And I thought, I'm going to write a book where the heroine has a little spunk and maybe even rescues herself every now and then. So that was kind of my goal. I was going to write a Western with a, you know, sensible heroine who was brave and, you know, didn't faint and, you know, all that stuff. So that was what I was aiming for the first time I wrote a book. So in that respect, Louis and his cohort inspired me.
That's funny.
That's great.
Well, as we're wrapping up, we want to know if you have any upcoming events you want to tell our listeners about. Any, you do have another Gaslight Mystery coming out, I believe, soon.
I do. I have a Counterfeit Lady book coming out in November. Oh. That's my second series, and it only has one book in it so far. This will be the second book. The first one is called City of Lies, and the second book is called City of Secrets. And this series takes place also in New York City, and it's set and starts in 1917 when America had just entered World War I. But it focused on the suffragettes who were being thrown in prison at this time for protesting and demanding their right to vote. And my heroine is actually a con artist who is running away from a con that went really bad, and someone's after her to kill her. And she joins the suffragettes demonstrating out in front of the White House and gets herself arrested with them, thinking, you know, that she'll be safe from these guys that are chasing her. They were arresting the suffragettes to try to scare them off, and all that accomplished was it just made them mad and more came.
My grandmother was a suffragette.
Oh, God bless her.
Yes, she was. She was very proud of that fact.
We have news articles with her picture.
She got arrested several times.
That's wonderful news. Well, the day that Elizabeth gets arrested with them is the day they decide to teach these women a lesson, and they sentence them to 6 months in a workhouse.
Oh.
Her little best laid plan got a good sidetrack. But she ends up in the workhouse with these women, and they convert her. And so she decides to start using her skills as a con artist to help people instead.
Have to read those.
Oh, that sounds good.
Well, that's what the series is. And the first book will be out in paperback in October, City of Lies, and the second one will be out in hardcover in November. So
great.
And then in May, April 30th, usually they come out in May, but this time it's coming out in April 30th, is the next Gaslight. And that'll be number 22 in the series. And that one's, you'll like that one because it features Mrs. Ellsworth quite a bit. Nelson has gotten married. And
I'm glad he found somebody after that last bit that he went through.
Well, this is kind of a bad experience, too, because someone in his wife's family gets murdered.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah. But Mrs. Ellsworth is there. And you'll notice that Mrs. Ellsworth now only gets one superstition per book. In the beginning,
in the beginning, it was every time Sarah went out the door, there was a new...
Yeah, well, this whole book of superstitions, and I thought, I'm never going to run out. But
So that's great.
This superstition in this book worked out really well with the whole plot. It takes... Sunday, New Year's Eve in 1899, and there's superstitions around New Year's, so that was very easy.
Very good.
Okay, well, we want to thank you so much for being on the show. We are so looking forward to all of your future books. We impatiently for the next one. And we want to wish you well, and we hope to talk to you again sometime.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is really fun.
Thank you, Victoria.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, that was an amazing interview. I was blown away by Victoria.
Such a nice lady. She really was very pleasant.
Yes, you'd think some of these authors would be, you know, a little uppity because they're so famous, but so far we've been very blessed.
Yes, the authors we've talked to. I have put these authors, especially these In Agatha Footsteps authors, up on pedestals for so long that I just cannot believe that we are getting the opportunity to speak with them and that our listeners are getting the opportunity to reap the benefit of that.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, get to know them as real people and not know them just through their books.
Exactly. That brings us to the end of another Agatha's Footsteps.
And wait till you hear, we don't want to spoil it yet, but we've got some great authors coming up for the next couple of months for In Agatha's Footsteps, so stay tuned.
Sign up for our newsletter and be one of the first to find out.
Absolutely.
You can go to our website at itwasadarkandstormybookclub.com and sign up for our newsletter that's going to be coming out every month. You'll be the first to know who's going to be next month's inductee. And remember, if you'd like to give us a comment or a review of our review, send us an email at darkandstormybookclub@gmail.com.
We will also update.
We'll update the show notes with her website so you can find out all about Victoria and her books.
There you go. Yes. Okay. Well, that does it for this episode. And I hope you really enjoyed it. I know we did.
So be sure and listen to our Bookends episode this coming Saturday, which will feature author Dennis Palumbo. It will be our Bookends number 13, or Lucky 13. And be sure and read for the next week, the next full episode, Chris Nixon's book. So we will be discussing those. So thanks for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next week. And remember,
life would be boring without a little mystery.
Bye.